Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Tapson. Thanks very much for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. Today, we're going to talk about the state of the union, the state of our sexual union, that is. And the short answer is, it's a disaster. I'm not talking about just the fact that we've reached such a low point in relations between men and women that men beating up women has become a spectator sport at the Olympics. I'm not just talking about the fact that pornography has become so ubiquitous and has driven a wedge in relationships deeper than the Marianas Trench, or that women are flocking to degrade themselves by creating OnlyFans accounts, while young men are flocking to artificial intelligence-created female companionship, or that abortion without restriction and without apology is the single most important value of the Democrat Party, and hence about half the country, or that there has been a 50% decline in U.S. birth rates in the last 75 years. Beginning in the 1960s, something began to go terribly wrong between men and women in this country, and I think you probably know what it is. It was the sexual revolution. And although I just used the word was, in fact, the sexual revolution was not just a single historical event, but its malignant influence continues to impact us today. And I think younger generations, who are arguably more impacted by the sexual revolution than anyone, have no clue what it was all about or how it has made them so miserable. Because even though today we are having more sex with more people than ever before, this supposed liberation has made whole generations miserable. My guest today at The Right Take is going to talk about that. She's written a must-read book that explains the origins, the ideology, and the devastating consequences of this sexual revolution, and what to do about them. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And let me say, as always, please take a moment to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already, so you can keep up with the conversations we're having here with important thinkers, writers, pundits, scholars, and storytellers. And if you like what you hear, a positive review would be greatly appreciated. Thank you, and don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, the founder of a nonprofit called the Ruth Institute, which I will let her describe in a moment. And she's also the author of books such as Love and Economics, with the very clever subtitle, It Takes a Family to Raise a Village, The Sexual Revolution and Its Victims, and most recently, The Sexual State, How Elite Ideologies Are Destroying Lives and Why the Church Was Right All Along. I think this is the book to read to understand the sexual revolution, not just as an historical event, but how it continues to impact us in detrimental ways today. Dr. Morse, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, Mark. I'm really excited about being connected with the Freedom Center and David Horowitz and all of his effort, because he's been a really important voice in the past few decades, and I'm honored to be on your show.
Well, the feeling is mutual. Tell us about the Ruth Institute. What is your mission there, and what compelled you to found it?
So the Ruth Institute is an international interfaith coalition to defend the family and build a civilization of love. And what prompted me to start the Ruth Institute back in 2008 was I had been an economics professor at Yale and George Mason University for about 15 years. And so I was a big free market person, big libertarian type of person. And then in 1991, my husband and I became parents of two children within 6 months' time. We first adopted a little boy from a Romanian orphanage who was 2.5 years old when we got him. And then 6 months later, I gave birth to a baby girl. And so to have those two kids 3 years apart in chronological age, but within 6 months of each other, we had my husband and me, you know, super nerd, nothing in my econ background prepared me for this, I want to just say. And my husband's an engineer, so if possible, even less prepared for what we were dealing with. But it was a controlled experiment, you know, because you could see so clearly that children need their parents. And our son absorbed a lot of time and energy because he had so many needs that were really quite desperate. You know, as a three-year-old, he didn't know his own name. And we didn't, you know, we were first-time parents. We didn't realize that that wasn't we didn't know how not normal that was. You know, we had to be told that that wasn't normal. And so the effort that it took to really help get him squared away, and the number of parents that we met who are similarly situated, we were in the first batch of people to adopt Eastern European adoptees in 1991 there, if you think about the timing of that, you know. So there were a bunch of us in the who were all facing the same problems. And when you see that, you know, that all these kids, all these orphanage kids had the same set of problems, you go, okay, there's something fundamental at work here. And, you know, so it's not a one-off, you know, we were not just exceptionally unlucky or something like that. You know, this is, there's something very big at stake here. And so, you know, after those years of, you know, being very intense in parenting and leaving my teaching jobs and all of that, a couple of years as a foster parent as well, the kids were getting older and, you know, it's time for me to, you know, start doing something a little different in addition to the full-time mom thing. And so I decided I would start my own institute to deal with the problems of the family, to talk in a systematic way. You know, what your econ training is supposed to teach you to do is to look at things systemically, right? So that I would talk about the problems of the family in a systematic way. And in particular, Mark, what I really wanted to do was to talk to young women about why it would be okay to start your family at a reasonable age, why you didn't have to wait till you got tenure, don't have to wait till you have made partner in the law firm. You know, you could start motherhood sometime before menopause, and it would be okay to do that. You know, that's what I, you know, in 2008, I thought, you know, and you know, I had been for a while, I was an approved speaker for the Federalist Society, and I worked with the Alliance Defending Freedom, you know, and so I had quite a bit of contact with college age young people, and I could see that this was a message that a lot of them wanted, you know. So I'm like, okay, that's what I'll do. That's a worthwhile thing to do. And then in 2008, when I was in San Diego at that time, Proposition 8 came on the scene. Proposition 8 was the California ballot initiative that that sought to define at the constitutional level marriage as a union of one man and one woman in the state of California. And that all got started in San Diego. And I was right there, and I knew kids needed their parents, and I couldn't sit it out. I couldn't say to myself, you know, this is not my issue. I don't want to get involved. I couldn't do that in good conscience, you know. So I got involved, and that steered my whole life in a very different way. It put me in contact with people I wouldn't have met otherwise, and connected me with issues that I didn't really want to be involved with, but felt that I needed to be because I had something to say that nobody else would say. And as people perhaps remember, that the voters of California in 2008 voted in favor of man-woman marriage. And so I then followed that as it went through all the court challenges. You know, I was actually in the courtroom in some cases, and it, you know, I spoke at state legislatures. Yeah, I was deeply involved in that. And so I got a ringside seat for what the sexual revolutionaries do and how they operate and what their methods are. And over time, it just became clear that this is not, there's no one thing here. You know, well, all these things, all these issues that seem like they're all coming at you from different directions, and we're just being bombarded by new garbage all the time. That's not the case. It's really all one thing. You know, it's the one thing is the sexual revolution. And if you can see that and analyze it, then it's not as overwhelming. You know, it's not as freaky. You have a sense of what you're dealing with, and you don't have to start from scratch every time. So at the Ruth Institute, what we do, you know, we hold that children need their parents, and the fact that children need their parents places obligations on adult society. And it means me personally, as mommy, you know, and daddy, we have personal obligations, but it also places structural obligations on society to incentivize people to do the right thing rather than undermining them when they're trying to do the right thing. And so that's what the Ruth Institute really addresses, is that whole set of questions. And if you step back from the sexual revolution, which, by the way, we should mention, it's very kind of you to say nice things about my book, The Sexual State. But it was published in 2018. And the thing is, it's still all true. You know, I mean, it's still all true, right? But one thing that's become more clear than ever, you know, in the 5 years that have passed since I wrote it, is that the sexual revolution really is attacking childhood You know, it really is attacking the fact that children need their parents. That's the thing we're trying to avoid. You know, that's the thing we're trying to talk ourselves out of, you know, that we don't really need to attend to that and that somehow it'll all work out. You know, oh, my golly. You know, and so therefore, the situation of children has grown more and more desperate in the years since then. So anyway, does that answer your question, what the Ruth Institute's about?
Yes. And in fact, you anticipated my question about do you think that things have gotten worse since the publication of this book in 2018?
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh. Yes. You know, in 2018, the trans thing was just breaking on the horizon. It wasn't that. Of course, when something's published in 2018, that means you wrote it, you know, in the previous few years or whatever. But it wasn't as clear, you know, how that was all going to unfold. Only in retrospect can you look back on it. And now you can see, you can see in, from talking to more people, you kind of put more pieces together. But Mark, I don't know how many people realize this. The Supreme Court redefined marriage in June, the end of June 2015. That's the Obergefell decision. The very weekend, that very weekend is the weekend that Bruce Jenner appeared on the cover of Vanity Fair. That very weekend. Okay. And the next week, is when Jazz Jennings' TV show, the reality TV show, started. That series started the next week. Okay, so you can't tell me that that's all coincidence. You know, this was part that the sexual revolution. You know, I knew that the gender ideology was part of it. I knew that undermining male and female was part of how these people thought. But just how intense they were about it. You know, now it's clear. Isn't it clear, Mark, that these people are all in for wiping out male and female? I mean, people have been fighting back, resisting it. They don't care. They're bulldozing everything in sight.
Yeah, absolutely. I do want to address that about male and female, because you have a chapter on that in your book, or at least you answer that question in one of your chapters. But let me back up for a second. Am I correct that the motto of the Ruth Institute is family is sacred?
No, that's not really right. I don't know where you got that. Oh, we have one time that appeared on some of our stuff and we took it off. That's not really, I wouldn't say that's our motto. I would say our motto is kids need their parents, therefore grownups need to behave, you know, but we do say defending the family. I don't know where you were going with that question.
Well,
I think I
saw it somewhere on the website. It may not have been an official motto, but just
correct. Correct. You may have, but we were just a little concerned about that wording, being misinterpreted. So, you know. I mean, there is a sacredness about male and female. There is a sacredness about marriage. I think everybody would agree with that marriage is something created by God for the benefit of the human race, right? And as it says in the Roman Catholic liturgy, in some versions of the liturgy, it says marriage was the one benefit not wiped away by the flood, not wiped away by original sin. You know, that God created marriage in the Garden of Eden, and it survived. You know, God didn't wipe that out. It's been damaged, of course, but it's there. You know, it's still ordained. And I think everybody, we are an interfaith outfit, you know, so we try to be a little bit careful with that kind of stuff. But I think everybody, you know, my Mormons, my evangelicals, the Orthodox Jews who follow that, they would all agree with what I just said there.
We live in a time in which the traditional definition of family is being, shall we say, deconstructed, and new definitions are being put forward that promote gender ideology. What happens, this is kind of a big question, what happens to a civilization when the nuclear family is dissolved and replaced by a kind of a loose, varied arrangement of relationships that may or may not even be biological?
The short answer to that is no one knows, because nobody has ever tried to do something on the scale of what we're trying to do right now. Okay, there was this one very famous study from a post-Freudian historian whose name escapes me. And it might come to me. But anyway, he analyzed, you know, many different civilizations, and he basically came to the conclusion that lifelong monogamy was the thing that kept a society strong and going, for a whole number of reasons, one of which, not the least of which, is that it channels people's sexual energy. into something constructive, and it enhances the rearing of children and so on and so forth. So, but literally, it's literally true, Mark, that you can't think of any society or civilization that has ever tried to say what we're trying to say. Because what we're saying, the sexual revolution claims that you can do anything you want. You can literally do anything you want sexually, and nothing bad will happen. Nothing bad will happen to you or anyone around you. You know, the problem has always been the taboos and the repression. If we could just get rid of all of that, everything would be fine. The kids don't mind. You know, if you have sex with a child, the kid, it's just because the grown-ups are upset about it. That's the only problem. You know, I mean, it goes that far into things that are completely counterintuitive and counter to any ordinary experience, you know, that people would have, right? So we don't really know what will happen, but we can't figure out that it will be anything good. I think we already can tell that this is not going to work. But still, we have people who are deeply committed to this point of view, you know, that that being allowed to do what you want is the most important thing. And we have very peculiar measures of the consequences, right? We sort of redefine people out of existence if they're in the way of people doing what they want. So and that's actually that'd be an interesting thing to talk about, is how we rationalize what we're doing. You know, the ways in which the propaganda. Since you read The Sexual State, you know that probably a quarter of the book is devoted to analyzing propaganda, different types of propaganda, you know, to keep this thing going. And so that, I think people find that very useful based on my talks and how people react in real time when I'm explaining this to them, you know, the look on their face and stuff, you know, because you feel like you're being bombarded all the time with stuff that is like, why am I really supposed to believe that? You know? Yeah, you are. Yeah, they really want you to believe that stuff, but they have to do it. The reason they have to do it, they're committed to something that can't work and that has no staying power of its own. And so therefore it has to be propped up all the time. And that's, you know, that's a key, I think, to understand the sexual revolution.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Let me get first to another question let's start more or less at the beginning here. People, I think, especially younger generations, really need to know what the sexual revolution was all about and how it's shaped our culture without us even realizing the pervasiveness of it and how responsible it is for so many of the issues that young people face. What was the sexual revolution? And what was and is the sexual revolution?
What was and what is, yes. I was just getting ready to say, you know, sometimes people hear that phrase and they think, oh, that's the stuff from the 60s. That's Berkeley or, you know, free love or whatever. And that's true. That's part of it. But that's not the main part that I'm interested in. I look at it as, you know, analytically, right? As you would think from somebody with the kind of training that I have, you know, okay, what are the three big ideas of the sexual revolution? That's the way I answer it. Because then you can, once you have those three big ideas in your mind, you can see it wherever it is, whether it's now or before or coming up or, you know, whatever. You can, across countries, you know what to look for. I define the sexual revolution this way, that there are three interlocking ideologies, and I call them ideologies specifically. The first is that the sexual revolution claims or holds or believes that a good society will do everything possible to separate sex from babies, okay? That it's a mark of a good society to separate sex and babies. And I call that the contraceptive ideology. And the sort of markers of that are not just simply contraception, but also abortion, because it fuels the demand for unlimited abortion, right? Because if your contraception fails, you got to have abortion as the backup plan. And the revolutionaries always knew that, you know, they were always talking about, oh, we need birth control for this and that. But always in the back of their mind was you got to have the backup plan, you know, because what they're really doing is saying it's okay to have sex in a circumstance that can't support a pregnancy, in a social circumstance that won't support a pregnancy. Well, what are you going to do then? You know, and abortion is one of the things that you do. But the other thing you end up doing, you end up having unmarried parents, and you end up with, you know, because you don't want to be married to this creep that you just went out with on a date, and you know, you don't want to have an abortion, but then you don't really, you know, he's not a suitable partner. So you end up, the contraceptive ideology, it's not the pill. People want to say it's the pill. It's not just the pill. It's the ideology. You know, if the pill was just sitting there on the supermarket shelf, that'd be one thing. But the fact is, they are relentlessly promoting the idea that sex is an entitlement, and that sex without babies is an entitlement. And so, therefore, all these other things flow from that idea, you know. So that's the first thing, is the contraceptive ideology separates sex from babies. The second idea is that a good society should do anything possible, everything possible, to separate both sex and babies from marriage. So you don't need to be married in order to be a parent. You don't need to be married in order to have children, okay? Or in order to have sex, you know, the baby, to do the baby-making thing. You don't have to be married to do the baby-making thing. And I call that, I refer to that as the divorce ideology. And behind the divorce ideology is the idea that kids don't really need their parents, that the kids will be fine. You know, if you are raising a child by yourself, if you're raising a child with a series of other partners, that the stable, lifelong union of love between the mothers and the mother and father, that is not worth fighting for. that is not worth being committed to. That's why I call it the divorce ideology. And spinning off from the divorce ideology is not simply divorce, but also unmarried parenthood, also repartnering, and also third-party reproduction, and that's the way I always refer to it, as third-party reproduction, where you're purchasing sperm or egg, where you're making a plan from the beginning of the child's life that they will not have the other parent in their life, and that the state enforces these contracts. This is why I call it the sexual state. The IVF industry could not exist without the state to enforce these contracts, you know, to say, hey, buddy, you masturbate into a jar for money, fine, but you have parent rights. You have parent responsibilities. We're coming after you. You know, that'd be the end. That just would, there'd be no demand for this product, right? If that was the way it was, you know? So the state is deeply implicated in all of these things. That's another theme of the book. But so that's the second thing, is the divorce ideology. Kids don't really need their parents, and therefore, you know, and then the third thing is that the sex of the body is not particularly important, and we can overwrite it if we want to. That the difference between male and female, the feminists wanted to say that it's socially constructed, therefore we can reconstruct social roles in any way we want, and we have an obligation to reconstruct those roles if it interferes with equality between men and women. We're obligated to overwrite those roles. Well, now that has come full circle, and people are saying, well, hey, we can just rewrite the body itself, you know, and because I have a social goal of having complete personal autonomy and deciding my identity, and therefore it's not only possible for me to rewrite my body, but society's obligated to support me in doing that. And that, I call that the gender ideology. So those are the three pieces. Those are the three big ideologies. And if you understand what's wrong with each one of those, then every time it rears its head, you have a starting place for addressing it, and it's not quite so overwhelming.
Yes, I often say that gender ideology, which is really, as you pointed out earlier, it really accelerated in recent years, in just the last few years, into the whole forefront of our cultural consciousness. I often say that gender ideology is just the tip of the spear of this cultural Marxist assault on civilization. What is the main idea that drives gender ideology?
Well, I think, honestly, it's a revolt against the body. Okay, the fact that we are embodied creatures, that look, people, I don't want to shock your listeners, Mark, but we're mammals. Okay, we're mammals. Mammals are male and female. The females have big gametes called eggs. The males have little gametes called sperm. You got to have a man and a woman. You got to have a male and a female to reproduce. And your young take a long time to grow to adulthood. We're in complete revolt against all of that. Male and female is offensive to egalitarians, right? Because if you're really egalitarian and you want everybody to be equal, that male-female thing is in the way. You know, and feminism knew that and resented it and fought it in various ways. But now we've ratcheted the resentment up to a whole new level, you know. And I have to say, because I'm sure you have a lot of free market, you know, libertarian type radicals amongst your listeners. And I love you guys, you know, but the libertarians also resent male and female in this respect. They resent the idea that I can't have a baby all by myself. See, this is the one thing where radical individualism just goes right down the toilet. I mean, you cannot do it alone. Somehow, you got to have the cooperation of a person of the opposite sex. Maybe you just go buy their sperm. But that's in that. If you really think that's a perfect substitute for having a loving, lifelong relationship with your child's other parent, if you really think that's a substitute, you're not really thinking. You have a distorted idea of what it means to be human, because who we are is an embodied thing. You know, the fact that I look like my mom or my dad matters to me. The fact that my kid's sister's baby pictures look exactly like mine, you know, all of the stuff of the body is something we're in revolt against to my way of looking at it. So I think that's one of the most dangerous ideas of it. And you mentioned the Marxist assault. Here's what it has in common with Marxism, to my opinion. Marxism was I think of Marxism as a fantasy ideology. You know, it promises something that can never be, you know, and once you get people to sign up for the goal, perfect equality, classless society, you know, and you once they're signed up for that, what ends up happening is you give a blank check to the people in power to do whatever is necessary to bring about the fantasy thing. And so what the sexual revolution does is it's got these each of these three interlocking ideologies, they're false. You know, they're not true. So if you can get people signed up for the idea that the body doesn't matter, okay, now you got a blank check. You know, they can do whatever they want, whatever is necessary to, you know, by any means necessary to bring about the impossible. Okay. And a lot of times, you know, as an economist, right, I was always like, but this is impossible. It's so stupid. Stop. You know, and I didn't get the point that the fact that it's impossible is not a problem from the perspective of the totalitarian mind. The totalitarian mind loves the impossible dream because it takes so much power to do the impossible. That's right. So we got to stop yelling at them about that and uncover the fact that it's just a cover story for a power grab. The whole sexual revolution is a cover story for a power grab to me. And that's why I called the book The Sexual State, because without the state, none of this would have gotten off the ground. I guarantee you, none of it would have gotten off the ground.
Yeah, I completely agree with you about the totalitarian aspect of this. I mean, that utopian worldview that says we can create a heaven on earth, we can perfect society, we can eradicate racism, we can eradicate poverty, we can change it if only we destroy everything that exists now in this flawed culture and civilization we have. If we just destroy all that, we can rebuild utopia on top of it. That is one of the most, if not the most destructive idea that human beings have ever come up with. And I love this quote from the book related to that. You say that the sexual revolution is a totalitarian ideology with a blind commitment to the implementation of its tenets, regardless of the human costs. That's a great quote. And I also love that you make this connection with, you know, between the sexual revolution and the state. And you say that it's never been a grassroots movement. It came about because the elites captured, as you put it, excuse me, the coercive power of the state and used it for their own ideological interests. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
I would love to, but before I do, I have to give a shout out to your friend David Horowitz, because there's a phrase in there that I use that I got from him. Like, I don't know, I can't remember when I learned this from David Horowitz, but he has many times said, the issue is never the issue. The issue is always the revolution. And I use that all the time now. And the revolution is always about power. That's the add-on that needs to be there. The issue isn't really about men and girls' bathrooms. The issue isn't really about the boxer in the Olympics. You know, the issue is never the issue. The issue is always the revolution and desensitizing people to the next step. for another level of a power grab, you know. And here's another thing I've said to people that seems to be arresting. If they can make you say Bruce Jenner is a woman, they can make you say anything. And that's the point. You know, the point isn't whether it's true or not. The point is whether they can make you deny the evidence of your own senses and make you question your own rationality, you know. Now, that was my opening response to something else you asked me. I forget what you asked me. What did you want me to, there was something else you wanted me to elaborate on, Mark.
Just most recently, I just asked about elaborating about the connection with the state, about how it's, the state is really behind the whole sexual revolution.
Well, starting from right now, even if you've never thought about the earlier phases of the sexual revolution, I would invite your listeners to just look around and see the fact that the transgender movement is clearly a top-down imposition. There can be no serious doubt about whether this is a grassroots thing. Okay, I mean, I just think it's happened so quickly, you know, and it's happened in such a coordinated fashion from the top down, starting with the White House. You know, the White House has this whole plan for, you know, how they're going to protect transgender rights. If you read that thing, that thing they put out on Easter Sunday, what that was Transgender Awareness Day, you know, or whatever it was, I forget exactly what they called it, but, you know, they had like a 24-point program where they were going to, where transgenderism was somehow going to be implemented in every facet of society. And you go, okay, this is a new communist manifesto for remaking all of society. This is that they're telling you. They're telling you flat out, this is what they intend to do, you know. So starting from today and just looking around, I hope that makes it more credible, right? When I say to you earlier phases that now everybody accepts and is kind of signed on for, they still have that same quality. So one of the longest chapters in the book is about the contraceptive ideology, because this is something everybody's attached to. People can't imagine the world without contraception. But here's the thing. Margaret Sanger and her little friends with the, the Connecticut outfit that pushed for what became Griswold versus Connecticut, the Supreme Court case that made it so that states could not have any regulation at all about the use of contraception. Their little organization, which changed names a couple of times, they went into the state legislature in the state of Connecticut starting in 1935. Every year they went in and said, we have to get rid of this law that says, you know, that regulates contraception. And every year, the people of Connecticut, the state legislature is like, no, we don't need to do this. No, go away, you know. And that they went year after year after year. And always, Mark, here's what they always said. Oh, all we want to do is remove this restriction for married couples with serious health problems. That's all we want to do. And people are like, you know, it, and by the way, this is all coordinated around Yale. Okay, the people who brought the case that finally became Griswold versus Connecticut, Yale Law School, Yale Medical School, okay, plus the little Planned Parenthood group that was there, the Bush family, Prescott Bush, was part of, okay, the Bush, George W. Bush's grandpa, I guess it would be, yeah. But anyway, you know, the little old people in Connecticut, they're like these little Italian immigrant ladies writing to their senator, we think this would cause a decline in public morals. What if high school girls start getting this stuff? That would be terrible, you know. And, oh, no, that'll never happen. That'll never happen. You know? And so after 35 years, they finally wore them down. And then the Supreme Court comes in and says, you know, yeah, this is personal. There shouldn't be any regulation at all. Well, then the next move was, not just are we protecting the marital privacy, because that was the argument in Griswold, the privacy of the married couple. Now, the state shouldn't interfere with that, with any kind of regulation about contraception. Okay. Within a few years, it was, well, if married people have this right, surely single people have this right, right? Well, in the background, and so then you have the Eberstadt Eisenstadt case in 1972, and then by 1973, abortion, Roe versus Wade. And they all, that group of people, they always knew that was their goal, that abortion on demand was always their goal. And in the background, while all this is going on, the Great Society is happening. Johnson, LBJ is, you know, pumping money into poor communities. And all of a sudden, they have a problem with out-of-wedlock pregnancy. Oh my gosh, there are too many of these poor people. We better do something to stop these poor people from having so many babies. And at the same time, they're promoting birth control around the world, even when it's illegal in the United States. So it's becoming part of U.S. foreign policy to go around the world and tell people how to do this. You know, and so it's like the idea that ordinary people wanted to sever the bond between marriage, sex, and babies, the idea that that came from the people, that's just factually incorrect, you know. And then no-fault divorce. Oh, my gosh, don't get me started on no-fault divorce. I mean, that started in, that was a movement of the American Law Institute. They had this idea of making divorce into like any old regular contract. You know, you can get in, you can get out. But they didn't see that what they were really doing, what no-fault divorce really does, is it makes unilateral divorce. Okay, it was sold to the public as, well, if two mature adult people decide they don't want to be married anymore, why should the state care about that? Let's make it easier for them to dissolve their union. That's what was said, but what in fact happened was that one party could end the marriage for any reason or no reason, never have to show any evidence, and the state always takes side with the person who wants the marriage the least. That's what no-fault divorce is, and the ripple effects of that have been horrendous. And, you know, we never really talked about it while it was going on. You know, we never really debated it, discussed it. And even now, it's hard to talk about people. You know, some people don't want to hear it at all. And other people, Bart, I start talking about the children of divorce. When I give these talks in person and I talk about the impact of divorce on children, it never fails. Young people come up to me with tears in their eyes. With tears in their eyes, they say, "You're the first adult I've ever heard say that divorce is hard on kids." And, you know, my dad just married somebody again who's 24 years old. And this is a girl who's 20. You know, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we've cultivated. You know, it's like we're cultivating disloyalty. What kind of society can you have when you incentivize disloyalty on this kind of scale, you know? So anyway, yeah, that the state's definitely involved in all of this. This didn't just sweep in off the coast like a hurricane or something. You know, there are a bunch of people who had a definite image of what they think marriage and family should be, and they've been systematically constructing it in society. And the people who are harmed by it very seldom get a turn at the microphone to say, "Hey, come back here and do something about this."
And I think the victims of the sexual revolution probably don't even realize, especially in younger people, that the sexual revolution is at the bottom of all this. Would you agree with that?
It's that I think that's very correct. That's very true. And that's why when I talk about it, and it's like a big surprise for people, but then they're excited, you know, or they're grateful or you know, like I just mentioned, you know, that helping people, I think one of the most urgent jobs is to help people connect the dots, you know, that so many things that are disrupted and difficult are flowing from these broken attachments, things that should be attached, that we're throwing away, you know, we're treating it like the attachment is of no significance, of no human importance. And the fact is, and I think there's science to defend this now, Mark, that the bond between the mother and the father is the foundation of the child's personality, right? Because mother and father love each other, and this is where I came from. I'm the result of their love. Now mommy and daddy say they don't love each other anymore, but they still love me. Well, wait a second. How does that even work? I mean, daddy's half of who I am and you don't love him anymore? What? And we're asking a five-year-old or whatever to make that make sense. Well, I think it doesn't really make sense, you know, and the long-term consequences of that are far, far beyond what society has really been willing to admit.
In the book that the Catholic Church has been the last, and in some cases the only, holdout against this supposed progress of the sexual revolution. And you say that the Judeo-Christian tradition offers an alternative vision to that of the sexual revolution, which says that sex has no meaning whatsoever apart from whatever meaning an individual might assign to it. Could you talk about that alternative vision that the Judeo-Christian tradition offers?
Yes, I'd really like to talk about that. Actually, I mean, the Christian tradition has always held that the human person is meant for love. And I think this is completely consistent with the Jewish tradition that comes before it, you know, that God created the universe as an act of love. He loves us, and he then inside the Trinity is love, you know, that at the heart of the universe is love. And the human person is meant for love. What's really going to make us happy is not acting on impulse. What's really going to make us happy is to love and be loved. And so if you ask, well, what is love? Love is not lust. Love is not, I like the way I feel when I'm around you. You know, love is deeper than that. Love is to will and to do the good of the other. That is the traditional Thomistic definition of love, you know, that's embedded in a lot of aspects of Catholic thought, you know. And I don't know any, I'm not aware of anybody saying, oh gosh, that's wrong. They don't explicitly deny it, but they implicitly deny it. But anyhow, if you think of to love as to be willing to want the good of the other person and to do the good of the other person, then it's much more than acting on impulse. You know, there's a cerebral component to it. There's a moral component to it. And it's just a whole lot deeper than what we are being offered by the sexual revolution. So that's the deepest point, you know, that the human person is meant for love. This is what will really make us happy. And it's also what will create a stable society. You know, it's what will allow a child to feel like they matter. Right. I matter because when I cry, my mommy comes and picks me up and holds me, you know, and when I make a mistake, my daddy corrects me, but he doesn't kick me out of the house or beat me to death. You know, I mean, you know, of course, no child articulates that. But the fact is, that's what you're building. And that's what you're building on. That's what the Judeo-Christian tradition offers. And if you really think about it, I have to say this is the Catholic tradition in particular, because we're the last guys to hold on to Jesus's statement that you're not supposed to get married more than once. You can only get married once. And if your spouse is still living, that's adultery if you take up with another person. You know, the Catholics are the last, you know, we really are the last holdouts on that point. But if you start to think about it, what Jesus did when he said that was radical. You know, if you look back in those passages in the gospel where he says that, the apostles are like flipped out, like, whoa, you got to be kidding. You know, well, wait, maybe we shouldn't get married, you know. And so it was radical. They knew it was radical. And the civilization built on that principle, one to a customer for life, is, you know, sort of my little paraphrase of it, you know. What it means is that for every man, there's one and only one wife, and for every woman, one and only one husband, and for every child, rich or poor, for every child, a mother and a father. For every child, a mother and a father. That used to be normative. That used to be normal. And now having a mother and a father is the privilege of the rich. And so, you know, all you egalitarians, just sit down and shut up. I have just had it with you people. Because this is much more important than all the children having the same lunch at school or having the same income. You're never going to create a world where everybody has the same income. That's, you know, that's crazy. And so in the name of those kind of superficial forms of equality, we've wiped out the deepest kind of equality, which at one time we actually had. You know, it actually was normal that every child, no matter how poor, had their mom and their dad. And no matter how rich you were, you only got one wife, man. One, only one wife. Just because you're rich, you don't get to hog all the women, you know? No, and that's what the alternatives look like. So, yeah, I think I say we need to defend it. We need to stop apologizing for it and pussyfooting around. You know, we've got something of great value to a lot of people, you know, and yeah, come on, y'all.
Absolutely. You close the book with what you call a manifesto for a civilization of love. And I don't want you to have to give away too many spoilers, but could you mention a couple of the elements of that manifesto, a couple of changes and solutions that you offer?
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you bringing that up because true to my libertarian background, I start off with stop, things the government should stop doing, things it never had any business doing in the first place. Okay. And so it's a 15-point manifesto, and the first 10 points are all things the government should stop doing. And at the top of the list is sex education in the schools. The government has no business telling children how to put condoms on bananas. And that's what I was talking about in 2018. And of course, as every sane person now knows, they're doing much worse than that in the schools, much worse. But the fact is, all of that was in place, all that infrastructure for promoting the trans thing, that infrastructure has been there for a long time, right? And even the deception of parents, you know, the way that I suppose your followers are aware that that schools are hiding from parents the fact that their child wants to change their name, or, you know, some states are making it so that the parents can lose custody of their children if they don't affirm, and so on and so forth. Well, the schools have been helping kids get abortions and contraception without parental knowledge. That's been going on for quite a little while, and certainly the education has been there. So that's huge. In my book, it's huge that the government gives itself the right to usurp the authority of the parents in that way. So that's a big one. Get rid of no-fault divorce is another big one. Get all the marriage penalties out of the social welfare programs. That's another big one. And that's something conservatives used to talk about that all the time, but we don't talk about it anymore. And the reason we don't talk about it anymore is that the revolution just keeps moving and they take territory, and it's like that's gone. It's like it's in the rearview mirror, but we have to address it. We have to think about it. So those are some of the things that the government never had any business doing in the first place that they really need to stop doing.
Dr. Morse, please tell people how best to keep up with the work that you're doing, whether it's on social media or going to the Ruth Institute website, that sort of thing.
Well, I appreciate you asking me that. We do have very active websites called ruthinstitute.org. That's your gateway into all the other things that we do. And we have a weekly newsletter that you can subscribe to, and you'll see our commentary on all sorts of current events and our more substantial long-term research and stuff. And then we also have a very active YouTube channel where we have once a week, basically, we put out new interviews that I do, often with victims of the sexual revolution, you know, people who have been through the mill in some way or another and have come out on the other side. And can testify and can help people connect the dots, you know, between the dumb stuff that we did, that we were induced to do, that we shouldn't have done. So we have those type of interviews, and also interviews with various kinds of experts who can inform people about the science that's behind our opposition to the revolution, and that is supportive of the, you know, broadly speaking, ancient Christian tradition. So those would be the two biggest places. We have a Facebook page as well, which is a lot of fun. And the YouTube channel, and then our main website. All that's good.
Good to know. Jennifer Roback Morse, thanks so much for coming to the Right Take podcast. Please keep up this invaluable work.
Well, thanks for having me, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. Listeners, check out Dr. Morse's very enlightening book, The Sexual State, and consider donating to the Ruth Institute, and also check them out on social media and on YouTube. And thank you, as always, for joining me here at the intersection of politics and culture. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so that you can keep up with all the important conversations we're having here. And if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.